Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Net neutrality is the idea that internet service providers may not play favorites with websites, that all content on the web is treated equally. Under the Obama administration, the Federal Communications Commission put net neutrality rules in place. But the Trump-era FCC has started the process of undoing that work. Senior reporter for CNET, Maggie Reardon, has covered the ongoing battle over net neutrality. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back, Maggie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First of all, talk about the rules that the Obama FCC put into place before he left office.
So the rules basically prevented broadband providers or wireless carriers from slowing down or blocking any traffic. They also couldn't create so-called fast lanes where they would charge companies to deliver their traffic faster to their customers. And so those are the three main ones that have been thrown out. And also as part of the rules, the FCC reclassified broadband as a public utility. And it did that to ensure that the rules could be enforced and that they could stand up to legal challenges. And that was the main thing that that Chairman Ajit Pai wanted to get rid of. But he also ended up getting rid of all of the rules.
Had those rules gone into effect?
Yes. They've been in effect since 2015.
Okay.
And Ajit Pai, the chairman, had argued that, since the rules have been imposed, it's had a negative effect on the broadband companies, that they aren't investing as much in their networks and they're not building out their networks, and therefore the rules should be repealed.
What is the connection between whether they invest in and build out their networks and rules governing how content is handled on the internet?
Well, it goes back to this idea of the reclassification of broadband as a utility. Mm-hmm. So the old style telephone network has this classification, which is called Title II, and it means that the government can regulate rates. It can regulate and tell the companies that they have to open up their infrastructure to competitors. And so the broadband and wireless companies really fought very hard against that classification for broadband, because they don't want those same kinds of restrictions, and they say that because of that utility designation, they're sort of afraid to build out their networks, because down the road the government may want to regulate rates or may want to tell them that they have to share that broadband infrastructure with a competitor. Chairman Pai has made the argument that they've seen this dip in investment. But I mean, honestly, when you look at it, I mean, it's only been a couple of years, mm-hmm. and there are lots of reasons why, there could be dips in investment, and they're investing different amounts of monies all the time in their networks, and the business is changing. So I think it's difficult to say that there was a direct mm-hmm. correlation there. Yeah.
Well, how much of a dip are we talking about?
That's the thing that's also arguable. There are some folks who are saying there really wasn't a dip at all.
Mm-hmm.
it just is how you look at the numbers. And if you look at what the companies have been telling their investors, they've been doing very well over the last couple of years. And even after the rules were adopted, they said to their investors that they didn't think this utility classification was going to change any of their business plans.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the issue of net neutrality. The current FCC in the Trump administration is working to undo rules that were put into effect in 2015 during the Obama administration that would guarantee that the content on the internet is treated equally by internet service providers, and also that the internet would be identified as a utility. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Maggie Reardon, she's a senior reporter for CNET, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Where do the big tech companies such as Google, Facebook, and Amazon fall into this debate?
Well, they are all in support of the regulation. And the main reason is because you know, they want to make sure that that customers can get to their services and their websites. You know, the real fear here is that if you have big broadband companies who now control, you know, they control the infrastructure. So think of it like a roadway. They control the roads and access to the roads. But they also now are starting to deliver their own content, and they're starting to compete against Google and Facebook and Netflix. And, you know, when you have that kind of situation, you know, they own the roads that they're, you know, delivering their services on. And so they really, there's a temptation for them to favor their own services over their competitors. And that could hurt companies like Google and Facebook in the future. You know, I think though those companies are so big now, which is, you know, they're even bigger than they were, you know, in 2014 when we were having this debate before,
right.
That maybe they won't be as affected because customers, you know, are familiar with those services. They use them. But what about the newer companies that we haven't even thought of yet, right? It just makes it harder for new upstarts to get to the place where Google and Facebook are today.
Why does not the idea of expansion at the startup level inspire the FCC Chairman Pai as much as expansion at the big business level?
Well, you know, if you listen to what Chairman Pai is saying, he's saying that he's also looking out for little companies, but he's saying he's looking out for the little broadband providers that are in rural communities. He's saying that these rules are too onerous for them and that they have suffered, and we really need those smaller players to be in the market so they can compete against, you know, bigger broadband providers. I mean, the real problem here is that for most Americans, there aren't enough choices for your broadband service. And, you know, it's an expensive endeavor for a company to go out and sort of dig up streets and put in fiber to build a broadband network. And it's similarly expensive for companies to develop wireless networks, too. You have to go out and buy the spectrum. And, you know, these are expensive businesses. And really, there's not enough competition in either place to really keep the market in check, which is the problem. But, you know, Chairman Pai says that if we want to encourage that kind of investment and we want to encourage that kind of competition, then we can't make the rules too onerous.
One regulation that remains in place is the transparency rule. What does that do?
So that basically means that companies have to tell you what they're doing, right? So if they are going to you know, in his proposal, he says he's, you know, they're stretching the transparency rule just a little bit further and making it so companies have to really tell you, like, if they are going to slow or block traffic, like, why they're doing that. They have to tell you if they're offering these so-called fast lanes or priority service. And that is a rule, that rule is still in place because that was a piece of rules, if you go back to 2010, that the federal courts actually said that was okay. The FCC has jurisdiction to be able to tell companies that they have to tell their customers what they're doing. But what the courts had said before is that the FCC doesn't have the authority, unless it classifies broadband as a utility, to go ahead and institute actual rules that tell them that they can't block or slow traffic, or that they can't, you know, have services like paid priority.
Seth in Columbus, you're on the air with Maggie Reardon of CNET. Hi, Seth.
Hi. I was just wondering, so I had a question about whether or not there would be any sort of implications with these changes that for people that have, you know, a internet provider that also provides other services at their home, as well as their cell phone service. You know, people use their internet for, you know, I don't know, like smart appliances or wireless systems in their homes. You know, how is that going to affect, you know, rates, or is there going to affect those markets as well?
Right.
Maggie?
Well, Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the fear here is that when you have a lot of consolidated power, so a company, as you're suggesting, might be providing you wireless, it's also providing you broadband, it's also providing you content. And so, you know, when you have all that control, sometimes that's called a monopoly. and so people are fearful that rates could go up, right? If they can, you know, basically, you know, make their service, they could raise prices for other companies to get access to the network, and that would raise consumer prices. They can raise rates on their service. And, you know, one of the other things that the FCC has done in this rules is it's saying, you know, FCC doesn't have any authority over broadband anymore. We're going to leave that up to the Federal Trade Commission. So then, you know, you've got companies that can raise rates to anything they like. And if there's no competition, they can do that. That's when, you know, I think most people would say that's when you need regulation. That's when you need, you know, the government to come in when there is no competition that can kind of keep things in check.
Seth, thanks a lot for that call. Eric in Dayton, you're on the air. Hi, Eric.
Hi, hello.
Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Maggie. Is Maggie in there?
Yep.
Yes. Yeah, my point is, as an amateur student of history, right, when the government first, when the telephone was a emerging technology, mm-hmm. It was also owned by private companies.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as those services became an essential part of human society, the government did take over. So the government was very instrumental in making sure that telephone connections were extended out to rural areas and make sure that all parts of the country were connected.
Mm-hmm.
Same with electricity and power.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, how is it different? Are we just in the infancy of the internet providers being private companies providing a service, which is becoming an essential part of our economy?
Okay.
The same way that those other services were. Why is the model different now?
Why is it different? Maggie Reardon?
Well, that really goes to the heart of this debate. And that's what the net neutrality supporters and what the Obama FCC was doing is they were putting broadband on the same regulatory level as the telephone network. Right. And, you know, I could go into this further, but, you know, there was about, you know, 12 years ago, the FCC had gotten into a Supreme Court case and they classified broadband as what's called an information service. So they made it different from this public utility. And I would say that's when the internet was really sort of in its infancy. And back then, the FCC was saying, you know, let's not have a lot of this regulation. Let's just see how the internet grows and what happens. And what we saw is that, you know, over the next decade, you know, you had some companies who emerged as very powerful, and there wasn't a lot of competition. And so the FCC said, you know, we've got to revisit this. We are the agency that has authority here. Let's reclassify this and put it on the same page as the telecommunications network. And so we're going to reclassify this as what's called a Title II service, and we are going to regulate it like you were saying, like the old telephone network, so that we have control here because there's not enough competition and everything's on the same page. So that's what we're getting rid of. I mean, the Republicans are saying, no, that's just terrible. If you look at the telephone network, it never, you know, it barely advanced. There was no innovation, right? You know, you mm-hmm. had a dial tone. That was about it.
Well, you just brought up the Republicans. I mean, this is a political football. It's not just between the tech companies and the FCC. There's politics, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is very politicized. I mean, we saw that in the last fight in 2014 and 2015, and we're seeing it again here. And, you know, really, the thing that's unfortunate is that I think partly because Chairman Pai sort of wiped out all of the rules and really, like, sort of went nuclear on this, you know, I think what we'll see is the next Democratic administration that comes in, they'll just reinstate the rules, right? They'll just, so it'll be this ping-ponging back and forth, which is really not good for the industry because these companies need more certainty to be able to operate. And so I think, you know, everybody's saying Congress needs to step in and do something. But as we all know, Congress really is very partisan right now and doesn't really get a whole lot of anything done.
And just real quickly, this is a process. They've started the process. What's the timeline here as far as the abolishment of these rules?
At their December meeting, they're voting. So they, you know, PI introduced the proposal in May. There were comments throughout the summer. They reviewed the record. And now what happened last week is he issued the final proposal, which will be voted on. And with three Republicans on the five-member commission, it's going to pass. And all three Republicans have said that they will support this. So there's really not a whole heck of a lot that can be done at this point. Although I know there are a lot of people saying, you know, to write your congressman to get noisy about this and maybe, you know, but the real thing is you have to change the minds of the three people on the commission. I guess you only need to change one mind, but they they have all opposed this from, you know, the 2015 rules for a long time. So I think it will be near impossible to change their opinion.
Maggie Reardon, thanks for joining us. Always appreciate your insights.
Thanks for having me.
Maggie Reardon is a senior reporter for CNET. We'll put her latest article on our link on a link on our website at WOSU.org. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Our increasingly automated and connected world has ushered in an age of unprecedented convenience where nearly anything can be got online. But these systems can be flawed. For example, a social media site that suggests a traumatic memory is worth celebrating, or a photo app that doesn't properly recognize dark skin tones. Humans, not machines, are the problem. Web consultant Sarah Wachter-Betcher, in her new book, examines how the values and assumptions of tech developers lead to unintended consequences. The book is entitled Technically Wrong: Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. Sarah Wachter-Betcher joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
What are some of the examples of biased technology that stood out most to you while working on this book?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that as I dug into the subject, I found that there were these examples that seemed kind of small on their surface. They actually stuck with me over time because they sort of pointed to bigger issues. One really interesting example of that I looked at was an investigation that ProPublica did last year into the way that Facebook was allowing advertisers to target their ad campaigns. And this has been really interesting as we've seen that Facebook ads have been in the news over and over again this fall, looking at the way that Russian ads were allowed to go out during the election last year. But when you look at what happened in this particular example with ProPublica, what was done is Facebook was letting people publish housing ads and target those housing ads by race. So you could select racial categories to include or exclude. And ProPublica immediately contacted Facebook and said, hey, that's actually against federal housing law. You can't discriminate against people by race when it comes to housing, and so you cannot put up these ads that are racially discriminatory. And what that really pointed to me was that, you know, Facebook has built this massive advertising system that is mostly run on automation, and it's effectively really easy to game. I mean, they couldn't get a handle on not letting people post racially discriminatory ads. And so what you start seeing is that problem spins out and further out of control until you get the kinds of problems we've seen this year, which is, you know, Facebook not realizing that it was allowing all these Russian-backed sources to purchase all these ads during the election. And so, in fact, you know, one of the things that's been really interesting about that story is that just last week or so, ProPublica found that Facebook was allowing those ads to slip through again, even though Facebook had promised it was fixing the problem and closing that loophole. And what it really points to is, you know, a little kind of small detail in the interface where when you were going in to target your ad on Facebook, you could select these racial demographics that might make sense for some kinds of ads. Like if you are, for example, running an organization that's specifically about, you know, helping Latinos in your community, or if you're running an organization that is trying to sell an, you know, ethnic beauty product, that some of these targeting mechanisms might be good or make total sense. Mm-hmm. But in this example, they were obviously inappropriate. And, you know, Facebook has built something that's just so big and so automated that it has not invested enough in how the ramifications of that system might work. And that's really kind of coming home to roost at this point.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about unintended consequences of all kinds of things when it comes to technology. My guest is Sarah Wachter-Betcher. She's a web consultant and author of the book Technically Wrong: Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, you write that most of these problems are unintentional. They're something that's built in, it's baked in, because humans are still sort of running the show, right?
Yeah, I think that's a big piece of it. But, you know, I would definitely distinguish between something being unintentional and tech companies being blameless. I think tech companies have a lot of power and therefore have a lot of responsibility here. And so much of this, you know, it does come back around to problems we've seen in tech for a long time that have been pretty well reported on by this point around, you know, the lack of diversity in tech companies, the lack of people who, you know, don't necessarily look like your average tech founder, which has been this kind of historical figure, the Mark Zuckerberg figure, right? The young white man. And the fact that companies really haven't invested enough in understanding that having such a lack of diversity in their staffs, and particularly in places of power, does play a role in these kinds of problems making it out the door.
Online harassment has been an ongoing problem on social media. How have the biases you write about come into play there?
Sure. Well, once again, what you find is that the biases of the people who make the technology find their way into the product. So you look at something like Twitter. So Twitter has been around now for over a decade. And when it started, it was founded by, you know, a small group of young men who were really thinking about this as a way to model an online version of the kind of CB radio networks that people who were doing deliveries and bike messengers had for a long time. And so this is their kind of cool idea. And what happened is that they built out that cool idea as this online platform, Twitter. And once it took off, a lot of people started using it who weren't really the users they'd originally envisioned. Pretty quickly, it became really popular amongst women. It became really popular amongst Black people. Black Twitter was something that was kind of showing up in the news, I think, as far back as around 2010. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, a huge growth area for the product. Well, as that happened, that's when we started seeing some of these issues with things like harassment cropping up, and we started seeing people writing about how Twitter was really easy to harass people on. You know, when you think about the way it's designed, anybody can follow anybody by default. You don't have to be friends, right? I can follow you even if you don't follow me. It's easy to retweet people, so your message can spread a lot further than you necessarily intended it to. And some of those things are what make Twitter powerful. But when you don't think about, okay, how could that be used to hurt somebody, then what you end up with is a system that's fundamentally flawed. And so if you haven't really updated your vision of what your product is and who it's for and how people might use it based off of the real world, then you're bound to run into these problems. And I think Twitter has really been guilty of putting blinders on for a very long time and not recognizing how different the reality was than their original intention.
Well, what is the incentive for Twitter or Facebook to improve? I mean, we're so many people use these things, even if it's a problem.
Well, I think, you know, in that respect, Twitter and Facebook are in pretty different territory. Facebook is worth, I don't know, I think it's over $500 billion is the current market cap. They're making a tremendous amount of money off of advertising. They are profitable. They are responsible to their shareholders. They have some clear reasons they don't really want to invest more in changing things. Twitter, on the other hand, has been notoriously troubled financially ever since it went public, and they have been trying desperately to figure out what to do about that or to sell the company. But I think in both cases, we have to look at the question a little bit differently. If we look at the question as purely one of saying, like, well, why should they bother if it's not going to make them more money, then we're suddenly in the territory of justifying pretty much anything, right? Like, you can say the same thing about, well, why don't you sell cigarettes to children? Well, we don't sell cigarettes to children because we decided that was not acceptable. We don't allow people to target advertising based on race when they're selling housing because we decided that was unacceptable. These companies need to have some pushback, and they need to be told, whether by the public or by regulation, that not just anything that can turn an advertising dollar is going to be acceptable. And I think that that is a difficult truth.
So where are those regulatory bodies located? What are we talking about here?
Well, you know, we're starting to see some interest in regulation coming from Washington, but it's really unclear whether that's going to pick up any steam at the particular moment. I don't think we have a good answer about what regulation should be, because I don't think we've reckoned culturally with what technology has done to our society and what role we really want it to play. As much as I think that tech has been underregulated, I also think that it's not necessarily a good idea for, say, government bodies that don't really understand technology to come in and make up laws that don't make any sense for the industry or the way people use it. What I think has really been lacking, what I really try to get at in the book, is that the general public needs to get a lot more comfortable understanding what's happening behind the scenes, understanding what's at stake, understanding the ways in which tech companies make these missteps large and small, and the ramifications that they have, and not looking at tech as being something that's magical. Because if we can start doing that, then I think we can have precisely those kinds of conversations about regulation or other kinds of pushback that make sense.
Eric in Dayton, you're on the air. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Hello, Sarah.
Hey there. Go ahead, Eric.
Yes. Actually, I was saying that, you know, this is a wonderful show. I wish I had discovered it further. And unfortunately, since I get most of my information from the internet, I had totally abandoned radio and almost stopped watching television. I'm one of those cord cutters. So I'm telling you, this is a wonderful show, and I wish I had discovered it earlier. I'm old enough to know what society was like before the technology and the internet and personal computers. Yeah, tech savvy enough, having worked in California and worked in East San Diego, Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. to know what the technologies that were coming. So actually, I'm seeing things now that were kind of like in the industry and in government long before the private sector started to get it.
Okay.
And one of the things that I recognize, and I think PBS did the NewsHour did a story on this, where the thing is, our society had never really before questioned the sources of the information. I grew up trusting Walter Cronkite. No one ever questioned whether or not Walter Cronkite got it wrong or not, okay? And so we trusted sources. In my early 20s, when I first got a very first VCR, the very first thing that I did was I would record all three national broadcasts of the news, and I continued to do that.
Okay.
And so what I realized that I did is I became a more critical watcher of the news by watching multiple broadcasts of the national news. I was able to compare and contrast.
Well, Martin, Eric, could you – I don't mean to rush you, but we're running out of time.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah. That's the point. The point is that we need to be more information savvy, and people don't do that. We're still in the 60s,
well, I mean,
trusting our sources.
Yeah, okay. But Sarah, does that apply here? Is this a consumer thing where they just got to be sharper, you know?
Well, I think that, you know, I would love if every consumer were sharper with the sources that they were getting information from. I went to journalism school, so of course I think that, you know, researching sources is critical, but I think that it is unfair to expect everybody to be able to parse out the extremely complicated landscape, especially when, you know, there's so much information online. I think that part of the reason it's so difficult is that companies like Facebook have blurred so many of those lines and sort of made everything feel the same, right? Because if it shows up in your Facebook feed, whether it's from a fake source or not, it looks relatively the same. And I think that that has consequences that we're starting to see play out. I don't think those are intended. I think that tech companies, you know, didn't really anticipate this, but they did definitely design their systems to make things feel like they are real and to make things feel like they are believable. Google has talked about this for years, that they really want their results to look machine-driven so that, you know, the more machine-driven the results look on the Google search page, the more natural and believable they are to people. And when you think about how that plays out, what that does is that does sort of flatten that, you know, the systems we would otherwise use to make sense of whether something is true or not. And you can't really tell the difference, right? Every headline looks the same. It's not like you're out at a newsstand where you can see a visual difference between a tabloid and like a more, you know, traditional newspaper. And so in that context, what I do think is I think that tech has definitely played a role in this. And I think that it now has to figure out what does it do about that. And I don't think there's an easy answer to that.
Okay. Thanks, Eric and Dayton and Sarah Wachter Betcher. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Take care.
Sarah Wachter Betcher is a web consultant and author of a new book. It's entitled Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Black Friday and Cyber Monday are over and done with for the year, but holiday shopping season has just begun. Every year we ask Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly to share his favorite tech gift ideas. Today we begin with gifts for kids. Russell joins us by phone. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Before we get into your gift guide, were there any Cyber Monday deals that particularly surprised you or of note?
You know, the one weird thing that surprised me, and this was something it just kind of just because it was out of left field, Amazon did a whole bunch of stuff that was just normal things that people buy, like toilet paper and tissues and you know, napkins and things like that, that were all on sale through their Amazon Fresh service.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a bunch of people who found that you know, they could do an entire week's worth of grocery shopping, just a normal week of grocery shopping on Amazon Fresh for almost half of what they would normally spend either through Amazon Fresh or in the grocery store. So that was an interesting way to promote that. It's a demonstration that Amazon is seeing this Fresh service as more than just a grocery service. They're also making sure that the people who are, you know, doing this online shopping, they're speaking directly to those people because those are the things that those online shoppers are looking for.
Hmm. Interesting. The first item in your guide for kids' gifts is a computer building project called, is it Kano or Kano?
Kano.
Kano Computer Kit Complete. You posted a really cute video of you building this with your son. How did it go?
So this was 45 minutes worth of work that my son entirely did on his own. The Kano computer box comes with a very detailed set of step-by-step instructions where you take a Raspberry Pi and you know, do all the wiring inside of this attached monitor that it comes with a wireless mouse and keyboard and its own enclosure and a speaker and battery and things like that. And at the end of it, you have a laptop. You have, you know, a monitor that can move wherever you want with a battery that'll last you a couple hours, and a wireless keyboard with a trackpad on it that you know that your child can effectively take anywhere. It connects to Wi-Fi just like a normal laptop. It has you know, apps and games just like a normal laptop, but it's running this special operating system that the folks at Team Kano have been working on for a really long time now. That is entirely focused on teaching kids the fundamentals of computers. We've talked a lot about things that teach kids how to code or mm-hmm. teach adults how to code. This takes it one step further and shows the kids, you know, how the processor works and how data is transmitted from pressing a button on a keyboard to showing up on the screen. And it presents it in this kind of retro RPG game. So the child has to, you know, physically travel through the computer world and understand how all of these different pieces work. And it's surprisingly functional. You know, my son played for hours this weekend after building it and came back and had a whole conversation with me about how how the processor works. That is a conversation that I guarantee you I could not have with people in computer sciences courses in college right now.
Why do you think putting together a computer like that makes such a difference?
I think it's two things. One, it's not just a thing that the child is handed, you know, like a tablet or something like that. So there's a whole lot less of the, you know, this works because it's magic. That a lot of things happen with consumer technology today just because it's so easy. So it gives this kind of deeper understanding that, you know, I built this thing and I know that there are parts in it and I understand how those parts work. And on some level, that's still really important. And the other thing, you know, that I think is so impactful about it has a lot to do with this software. You know, the software mm-hmm. is built to do more than just get them to an app or get them to a messaging service or something like that. It's designed to show that there's a lot more to using a computer.
Give me an example of how it does that.
So the best example is when you start off in the game, you have you start off basically in one of the USB ports. And so you have basic programming exercises that you can complete to demonstrate, you know, how data is coming in. You're pressing a button on a keyboard or something like that. But in order to get to the next steps in the game, you have to follow along in this adventure to the processor and learn things like how your computer receives system updates and why those updates are important and how the processor handles all of these things, you know, all of the time, and what happens when there are too many things going to the processor at once, or what happens when the processor gets stuck doing one thing over and over again. And so these concepts, you know, they teach kind of the basics of computing, but they also help help the kid understand what's going on when something is wrong. You know, so my son encountered a problem, and instead of just turning it off and turning it back on again, he understood where the problem was and actually knew where to go in the game to try and diagnose that problem.
Huh. Tell us what you think the age range is for the Kano Computer Kit Complete.
I think you could start as young as five, as far as, you know, being able to assemble the computer and being able to do some of the basic things in here. And the idea of having, you know, this piece of technology that belongs to that person, you know, this is your computer. I think that's a powerful thing for someone who wants to learn more about that. But really, as far as the programming and fundamentals of computers goes, you could go as high as 10 or 12 and have this still be a really impactful experience.
And it's something that you can get at five, and can you use it and build on it?
Absolutely, yeah. This is all built on the mini PC architecture called Raspberry Pi. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even when the child is done with the Kano operating system and they want something that's you know, a little more capable, you can put it's so many different operating systems on a Raspberry Pi computer. You can put Windows on it. You can put Linux on it. You can even put Android, the phone operating system, on it. There's a lot of options that are available for this computing platform. So it definitely is something that can grow with the user with no problem.
Does he get to keep it, Russell, or are you taking it away from him?
No, he gets to keep this one. And he's been very good about it. As far as, you know, knowing when he's allowed to use it and figuring out what to do with it. I did run into a problem where he figured out how to get to YouTube faster than I could figure out how to turn it off. But that was a short-lived problem.
Okay, how much does it cost?
This kit is $249 in most stores. They've been on sale. They were on sale for Black Friday for $215, I think. You could find it on Amazon, but they are surprisingly all over the place right now. They're in Microsoft stores. They're in Target. They're in Best Buy. They are very easy to get a hold of this year, and it's the one thing that I'm recommending to just about any parent this year.
What I like, just, you know, from observing it, is that you can see the components on the back.
Oh yeah, the back shell is entirely
clear. Kids love
clear,
that.
So you can, yeah, it's great. And as a child of the 90s, transparent technology always makes me smile. So.
Okay. Another gift idea you have is for a tablet. You like the Amazon Fire HD 10. We're talking about for kids, right?
Right. If you're looking for a tablet for a kid, if you specifically want a tablet for a kid, if you're going to be, you know, traveling or anything like that, there really isn't a reason to get anything other than an Amazon Fire tablet. They come in a couple different sizes. The 10.1 inch one is the largest of the ones that are offered. So it's, you know, if the goal is to give a tablet, you know, so that they'll be watching movies, and this is probably the better option. But it's a full tablet with tons of apps and probably the best set of parental controls out of all of the tablet makers right now, as far as parents being able to set specific times that kids are able to play or durations of time that they're able to play. So for example, I can set it up so that my son can play for 45 minutes in any of the games that are on his tablet. He can play for 45 minutes. When he reaches that 45-minute mark, the operating system will automatically set up a flag and say, hey, you've used all your time today. But it doesn't just completely turn off the tablet. There are other things. If I have enabled him to, you know, use the web browser for research or you know, Netflix for watching a movie or something like that, those are automatically separated by virtue of the parental controls. So there's just a lot of flexibility there for parents.
This Amazon Fire HD 10, it's improved over time, right?
This is something that, you know, all of the Amazon Fire HDs have been, this has been Amazon's direct approach at competing with Apple for a long time. And instead of competing with them on, you know, hardcore features or design or anything like that, it's been very simple, where they've been just kind of a step behind on purpose, but they've also been just insanely cheap compared to what you would pay for an iPad.
Which is nice when you're thinking about giving it to a kid.
Right. And all of these, you know, all of the different tablets, they have, special kid editions that come with great big rubber bumpers around the tablet, or you can just buy them separately if you want to buy just the regular tablet.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of flexibility there for kids.
Age range?
Really, any age range. This is something that, you know, adults can use too. If your goal is to have something that is, you know, a video player in the car, this could be, you know, really two and up.
And as they age, you have other options as well, but just besides watching videos.
Yeah, the Amazon App Store is massive. There's just so many different things that can be done. So there's not a specific, you know, your child's not going to get to age 5 and decide that, you know, everything on here is just for kids.
And the price tag?
So the 10-inch tablet is $149 for just the regular tablet. The 8-inch tablet is just a little smaller, but it's also almost half the price at $79.
Oh, very affordable, I guess, in the realm of tech.
Yeah.
Let's see. Another idea for a tablet. Well, I'm sorry. The next on your list is a watch for kids. And I thought this was kind of interesting that you're interested in watches for kids.
So the very first time that I saw this, I kind of laughed and went, okay, so this is fine. But then my son's friend had one, and you know, not only my son, but also my older daughter, my much older daughter, were just amazed by how cool this thing was and wanted one, which was silly to me because it's made by VTech, who has made, tons of different, you know, tech things for kind of age six to eight for a long time.
Right.
And this is basically, a smartwatch that doesn't connect to anything. It's designed to be a toy that the kid wears on his wrist to look like mom or dad when they're wearing their smartwatch. It has this little screen on it that has very simple apps and times and alarm clocks and things like that. But it also has a camera so that the kid can take pictures from their wrist, and those pictures can then be moved to a computer later on. There's no wireless radio or anything to transmit anything anywhere or to give away location data or anything. It's a very simple, what would normally be kind of a phone-sized toy that VTech would make, but just kind of put on a wrist strap.
The picture quality.
Yeah, it's not great. You know, the, okay. the camera on this thing is very, very basic. And I think the storage on the inside, you know, allows it to hold, you know, probably a thousand videos or something like 11 minutes of video. And then the video quality is not spectacular, but it's, you know, it's designed to be this kind of cute thing to for the kid to kind of enjoy. The battery is pretty good in it from the testing that I've done. And they did several, you know, visual kind of flourishes this year to line up with the new Star Wars movie. So there's an orange and white one. Yeah, there's an orange and white one to look like BB-8 and a red and black one to look like the First Order. But there's normally just that kind of stereotypical blue for boys and a purple with pink flourishes for girls.
And well, I'm kind of curious about your older daughter, what she finds interesting about this.
It was the idea of having a camera on the wrist, you know, being able to very quickly access it was something that she was, you know, she thought was very cool. And then there's a couple of very silly games on it. There's like a tic-tac-toe that's on it and stuff like that. And she was surprisingly impressed by all of those things that were on there. And it just caught me off guard that it was something, you know, I would have immediately rolled my eyes at that otherwise.
What about the price? Is it a good VTech price?
Yeah, so these are normally $50 if you go and find them in Toys R Us or something like that. If you head to Amazon, the red and black First Order one is actually $35 right now, but all of the others are either $50 or $60.
And we're talking about, again, like little kids?
Yeah, this is, you know, you start at, you know, age 4 or 5. There, it's, you know, you can go probably up to age 8 or 9. This is, you know, it's a very basic toy, but it's cute, and the camera really appeals to kids.
Another gift you like is the Zumi digital microscope, which, gosh, I wish this would have been around when my kid was a kid.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, this was very cool. It's this bright purple ball that has a little plastic tube at the end, and it's a very simple 2x handheld digital microscope. You plug this into your PC or your Mac, and you can, you know, you put it, you know, put the little tube over anything, and it'll show you, you know, up to 54x magnification, but a lot of that is digital magnification, so it just kind of blows up the picture instead of actually using microscope tech, like the actual lenses to zoom in on stuff. So it's this little simple palm sized thing, and the USB cable isn't particularly long, but it's just long enough that you can set stuff on a desk, and your kid can take this purple ball and set it on top of stuff and see the magnified version of it. And I just thought that was incredibly cool.
What things did you look at?
We started with pennies so that they could see pennies, and then a couple of rocks. And then this is kind of a thing that I like doing because it grosses out anyone, no matter regardless of who they are. I took the tablet that they use. I zoomed in to show them all of the grime on the screen and all of like the dust in the corners and stuff like that. And that is one of my favorite things to do to gross people out, because even people who like meticulously clean their phones and they love, you know, how much, you know, pride they take in taking care of their electronics, showing them just how much crud is in it that you can't see unless you zoom in. happy. Mostly because I'm really tired of seeing people using their phones in the bathroom.
Okay. We've heard this rant before.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll hear it again. But Russell Halley, for now, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time, as always.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Halley, contributing editor at Android Central. He'll continue his gift guide suggestions next week on Tech Tuesday. So thanks for tuning in this week. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.